we spoke last week about the Aleph Beis. We have Kel Baruch Gedol De'Yachir Pa'al Zerich Hamad. The article has kindly enough, do you have a five sitter maybe?
I do, well, right now.
No, I'm saying, we don't seem to have the same pagination. You have the same pagination?
Page 86.
Oh, you do? Okay. So the bride was kind enough to put the Aleph Beis in bold letter, so you have the Aleph, the Beis, the Gimel, Dalet, and so on and so forth. And we basically got up to the Meh, where it says, Me'olos Natan Tzivos Uzo, God put the luminaries surrounding his strength. Now, meaning that the luminaries in the heavens really are the kind of facade, I guess would be the right word, for Hashem's power. Hashem, of course, the heavens, when we talk about Shemayim, the heavens of God, they're not an actual location because the heavens are not spatial. But nevertheless, for our purposes of human understanding, God allowed human beings to speak about the same location where he is to be found as Shemayim, which is the same location in which the heavens are to be found, meaning the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, and so on and so forth. So, when we talk about the heavens, it has two meanings. The heaven means the heavens literally, and the heavens meaning that spiritual place where God, so to speak, not God resides, but where all sorts of spiritual things occur.
How do we know which meaning is?
We don't.
By context? Or?
Only by context, right. So the that's in fact why fear of heaven is very often called Yirat Shamayim. But yeah, fear of heaven is called Yirat Shamayim. Fear of God, or something, is called Yirat Shamayim. You know, fear of heaven, it's kind of strange, because, you know, why should we be afraid of heaven? Should we be afraid of God? Why is it not called Yirat Hashem? We don't say Avas Shamayim. We don't say love of heaven. We say Avas Hashem, love of God. And when it comes to Yirat, to awe, to fear, we say awe or fear of heaven, Yirat Shamayim. So the reason for that is obviously because Hashem created the heavens as an awesome spectacle from which one is supposed to be able to perceive, if this is so awesome and incredible, how much more so should the real, so to speak, Shemayim, the heavens which are beyond the heavens, be also awesome and incredible. The rabbis give a allude to this when they say that the reason why there's chelet, the blue color in the citrus, is because the chelet is zoy mel yam, the blue is like the blue of the sea, and the sea is like the sky, and the sky resembles God's holy throne, the kisei hakavod, or the God's throne of honor. So of course, you know, God's throne of honor is no specific color, doesn't exist in spatial or in color terms. So, but nevertheless, the concept of Shamayim, of the vast and infinite heavens, was meant to instill the sense of awe within a person, and that's why we speak about the awe of heaven, Yiras Shamayim, as opposed to using what we would expect to find, Yiras Hashem. So that's why we stress in this bracha, among other things, that Hashem gave and put the luminaries in the heavens, and they demonstrate, or they surround, and they're the facade of Uzo, of Hashem's strength, and he made all these mighty things, endless things in the heavens. Pinot Tzva'ov, Kedoshim, Rolamei Shakai. The leaders of his legions, literally pinot usually means corner, but here it means the leaders of his hosts, of his armies, our kedoshim, are lifted above and beyond our perception, and the Rolamei Shakai, and they uplift God in turn, meaning that Hashem created not just the planets, but also the angels. There's a source in I think it's a Medrash, maybe it's Gemara, which links the planets or the stars to the angels. And Arya Kaplan, one of his more interesting essays, writes that the reason why this is so is because how the question arises, how do you differentiate between angels? All angels are abstract beings or entities, and they have no face nor any countenance of any sort. How do they not duplicate each other? Why are they not redundant? By human beings, the reason why we're not redundant is because we look differently. By malachim, angels don't look like anything. So if they don't look like anything, how do you tell the difference between the two of them? So he wants to contend that's why Malachim are associated with different planets. The reason they're associated with planets and stars is because the difference between the star and the planet in association with which the Malach is associated differentiates the Malach himself. Meaning that only way to differentiate something is by pegging it to something physical. And the Malachim are therefore pegged to something physical in order to differentiate between them. So therefore, you know, there's two aspects to angels, or I should say two aspects to planets. There's two aspects to planets. One is that planets demonstrate the honor of God, which is a very awesome spectrum we see. But besides that, there are also the heavenly bodies, whether they're planets or stars. But besides that, they also serve to differentiate Malachim. And that's how each Malach is associated with a different planet in order to have, or star, in order to differentiate between them. Okay, I don't know if that's, I don't know if I buy it or don't buy it, but it's an interesting theory to have.
What did you say when stars explode?
What? But the third Malachim, the third Malachim, the Gemara talks about, the Kabbalah, the talks about Malachim, who rise up, say praise, and then go back into the river of fire. So, there are temporary Malachim too, right?
Shooting stars, right.
So everything, not everything is permanent, and that would also be reflected by the impermanence of certain heavenly bodies. So in any event, the Pinoso of Toshim, Ramesh Asai, as he says here, the corners or the leaders of his hosts are holy, and they uplift God, and they uplift God, again, as angels, by manifesting Hashem's power, Hashem's might, but more Hashem's mission in this world. Now, as we mentioned last week, a malach is really an abstract concept. A malach doesn't necessarily refer to a creature with wings, but rather refers to an abstract spiritual concept. And we call it a malach, an angel, for want of a better term. There's no term we have for abstract spiritual concept, which makes it more relevant to us than the term malach. The term malach in itself means an agent or a messenger. So therefore, when we talk about the malachim, there are many kinds of malachim. There are malachim which represent all sorts of spiritual forces in creation. And all of them, all those forces, are part and parcel of what uplifts Hashem. How does it uplift Hashem? Because these four forces, the spiritual forces by which the world is controlled, are the purpose for which Hashem, purpose is the right word, but they are part and parcel of Hashem's master plan, that there should be spiritual conducting or governing the physical, and if a person can perceive that there are such spiritual realms, then Hashem is uplifted by the complex and wondrous array, not just of physical things, but the spiritual things, spiritual forces which make the physical things grow or flourish or exist. So these uplift Hashem in the name of Shakai. Again, as we mentioned last week, some of the words here are just put in order to make the olive base fit. But the Shakai, Shin Dal Yud, is the name which is associated with Hashem having made the creation and carefully calibrated Amar Olam Ozai. He set the world enough. How much revelation there is and how much concealment there is. And part and parcel of the revelation by which Hashem is uplifted despite the concealment is the concept of Malachim, the concept of angels. And Talmid Mesaprim, these angels, the spiritual forces, Talmid Mesaprim, quote, Kel Uktusha, so they always relate over the honor of God and His holiness. Meaning, we human beings don't always relate God's holiness. Matter of fact, we spend relatively little of our time relating God's holiness. The physical world doesn't necessarily relate God's holiness in an explicit, overt way, but the Malachim do. The entire concept of Malach as a messenger of Hashem is to tell over, not necessarily to tell over because they want to say it to anybody, but rather that's an automatic response when you're in the presence of Hashem. They tell over for the honor of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, what's interesting about this bracha is that this bracha declares things lots and lots of stuff about Malachim, and for us, this is completely weird. Because what experience, at least I have never experienced contact with a Malach. Has anybody here ever experienced contact with a Malach? No. But the bracha takes this as a matter of fact. that all sure, there are all those malachim out there, right? And all the malachim say over the praise of God, and they're all, you know, uplifting God, and they're all controlling the world under God's supervision, whatever it is. So this bracha actually takes malachim as a real concrete concept. And it feels that it's essential. Bracha was made by Chazal, because it's essential to understand that there are spiritual forces which exist in the world other than human beings, and those spiritual forces are the intermediate stage by which Hashem runs the creation and by which we reciprocate to Hashem. That's why we say whenever we do a mitzvah, we create a malach, because this is the interface between us and Hashem. And the bracha takes this very matter-of-factly as if, yes, of course, you never heard of a malach before, you never saw a malach before, you're out of your mind. The malachim all over the place. There's interesting halacha, we don't do it anymore, but the halacha is still on the books.
The Shulchan Aruch? I thought the universe accepts all halachas in the Shulchan Aruch.
Well, you were wrong.
That's what you said.
We accept them, we don't necessarily keep them.
I see.
The Shulchan Aruch says actually goes by the Shulchan Aruch. I'm sorry. She comes to Beit Hakisei. When you enter the bathroom, Yomar, you say the following. He's got. You familiar with this?
Is this where you like ask, you like say sorry to your malachim?
Yes, you excuse yourself from the malachim. It says, Hiskatu mechubadim, be honored, honored ones. And it says it just v'chule, because it doesn't bring down the entire, etc., it doesn't bring down the entire language of the statement. But when you enter the bathroom, you're supposed to say, you know, so malachim is coming with you, excuse me, I have to attend to my meeting, so I'll be out in a few moments. And so the Shulchan Aruch says, v'achshav lo nagu lomo. Now, we don't say it. The Mishpah says, "Ki ein anu muzakim yirei shamayim." What is that? Yirei shamayim. Because we're not assumed to be fearful of heaven. Shemalachim malachim osano, that malachim accompany us. Shenavakshen, and we should have to ask them. Shemtinu, to wait aleinu for us at Hashem Eseh, until we leave the bathroom. But in theory, the Gemara says, when you walk into the bathroom, you're supposed to say, "Excuse me, to all the malachim are accompanying you." In order that, you know, they shouldn't feel slighted that you're walking in without taking leave of them. So again, it's kind of like talking to a world in which malachim are to be, you know, said to be an everyday occurrence, sure.
So if you say this prayer, do they wait outside or do they come in with you?
They wait outside.
They wait outside?
Yeah.
And that's why so many people fall in the bathroom.
They're going to fall in the
bathroom.
Like slip in a tub?
Did some rabbis back in the day that they...
Why not? I mean, it says the Beit Yosef, the author of Shulchan Aruch, is supposed to have had a malach who spoke to him, spoke out of his own mouth, as a matter of fact, and communicated with him.
What do you know?
A whole book. There's a whole book called Makid Meisharim. Makid Meisharim is all the stuff that the malach told the Rabbi Yosef Karo.
Is it good stuff?
It mostly says to learn Mishnayos a lot.
I have a little list of books that I made to buy, like when I first came to Yeshiva, and Magid Meshurim was on there, and I had no idea what it was.
That's right.
Magid
Meshurim.
Would it be a fair analogy to say that angels are like, you know, we have power lines outside the house, and when you get the power into your house, they have to go through something to make it much less powerful in order to be able to use a wall socket. Otherwise, if you were to plug your appliance into the power lines, it would blow up the appliance. Our angels like sort of like the screen that we that instead of Hashem doing something directly, which would fry our brains, so to speak, Malachim are the ones that do it.
Yeah, but the thing that's true, that's a good analogy, but we still have to realize that Hashem could have designed the world in any myriad amount of ways.
Right.
He didn't have to design as Malachim. Yes, he chose to use the Malachim as kind of buffer between him and us, right? Remember, nevertheless, now it's a Dabdu Malach. Okay? Important. You're davening here and mentioning what the malachim say. And that can never daven to a malach. not permitted.
When you daven, do the Malachim take your davening up there, or do they bypass the Malachim?
What?
When you daven to Hashem.
Right, the Malachim are the conduit of the prayers.
So we don't daven to them, we just daven to Hashem, and they know where it's supposed to go.
Right, they plug it in where it's supposed to go.
Rabbi, what about all the Mazikim and Shadim and all those? They also come with you to the bathroom?
I assume they say they come to the bathroom, yeah.
Thanks,
Shadim.
You don't
have to excuse yourself from there.
No.
Who's this? They come with
you. Demons.
So. Well, they're in the bathroom, right?
They could be anywhere.
That's not fair.
Why's not fair?
Not good. I don't know. If you're in the bathroom, you read something. I don't know.
Just don't believe the demons. You want to lay down.
Don't believe
them
there anyway.
What?
I thought they are there
anyway. How many do you believe in that?
Your belief creates reality?
They see them as a key and they see a thing over their head and all that.
Then they exist.
The thing that what we believe is what really exists?
To a certain extent, yeah.
Alright. Cool.
Like I said, it's a self-philosophy. Do you want to answer this one?
You cited a book which was written supposedly by what the Malach said to this author. Are there any other books within Judaism that are authentic, not authentic, but that are accepted within Orthodox Judaism, where people write about revelations from angels or departed spirits, where they say interesting things that are sort of novel? They don't say, study your Mishnah. Nothing great at it.
No, not Nostradamus, okay, it's not Synodotus. No. There is, I shouldn't say that, there are some, if you read that Ari Kaplan's Meditation in Kabbalah,
mm-hmm.
So there is a book, the part of it discusses Rabbi Avraham Abulafia. Rabbi Avraham Abulafia was a controversial fellow who claimed to live in the 1300s, who claimed to be a prophet, and he writes all sorts of prophetic stuff in his book. So,
there you go.
If you want to really see inside of stuff, he's supposed to be Mr. Exotic.
What's the book called?
I don't remember. I don't know. I have to quote him extensively.
Isn't it our beasts actually creating
angels? That's the way Chazal describes it. Robert describes it as beasts creating angels. It means our beasts have spiritual impact on creation. Angels, excuse me, are a convenient way to grab the concept of spiritual forces and make it more tangible for us.
So then by doing something physical, it works both ways then.
What do you mean both ways?
Well then by doing something physical, you're actually creating a spiritual construct.
Correct.
Okay.
A physical myth, particularly, or a veil. Say good angels and bad angels.
So when you daven, that creates the angel whose job it is to your prayers to
our temple. Yeah, I mean, they say, I forget what it is, that every word you say in davening makes a little angel, and that angel goes up to heaven. So what does it mean? It means that your words have spiritual forces, right? You say a word of davening, you say it with kavana, you create a very powerful spiritual force, right? You create one of those, you know, Charles Atlas's angels, right? You say a word,
a Charles angel?
Yeah.
That's a shade of...
The, You say a word with davening with very little kavana, right? Or no kavana whatsoever. So you create a damaged angel. It does can't cross. It doesn't go up to heaven. I think I told you last week, the Baal Shem Tov once came to a shul, a huge empty shul, and he said, "Wow, is this shul so bad? I can't even stand here. There's no room for me." So they said, "Listen, there's nothing here. It's empty. There's nobody in the room." So he said, No. All the tefillos which were davened here over the years and didn't go up to heaven because they weren't said properly, they're all down here on the shul. And there's no room to move around because they're all here. Right? So we have all these spiritual forces, you know, they're trying to flap their wings and go up to heaven. They can't do it because they're not, they haven't been given the right drive, the booster to get there. Yeah.
You never take a visual form, one you can see?
They do. That's why we have a chumash, they take visual forms.
Because there are some, quite a few testimonies by our enemies that we had quite a few angels protecting the borders in several occasions, different wars, 67, 73. That's documented stuff, like serious stuff.
Do you believe it?
A I mean, if he made it to a military history, if it's documented, this is not a guy sitting imagining things. This is a unit that they swear that they saw thousands of, like white soldiers aligned, and they didn't dare shoot or going towards them in places where we know we had no soldiers at all, let alone dressed in white and...
I'm skeptical. I never heard such a name before.
And show some testimonies. I have a DVD.
I'm a pretty big history buff. I never heard of those, that kind of story before, yeah.
What about the official version, why the Syrians didn't continue on from the Golan Heights? They just stopped. And the official version is that they didn't have orders. But many soldiers there, including the heads of the divisions, they said, you're not, how can we continue? We saw so many white, people standing in white, just four huge giant, thousands of them. And we had 50 tanks total the whole place.
It could be the Syrians were high on something, I don't know. I'm skeptical.
Well, anything about the angels is skeptical because
they can take on the clones has many stories in which they take on human form, or at least can be seen in human form, right? That's certainly the case. I just don't know about this specific
also the shaman, like the Gemara gives a procedure to see them with your eyes if you want. It's where it says the whole thing with the black cats and the throw the ashes into your eye and then you'll see the demons.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they said there is procedures to see.
Well, there's an amazing Mihiri. It's worthwhile knowing this Mihiri. You don't remember anything else from the time, but none of this Mihiri. The Mihiri says, by the way, last week I went, because of one of my other jobs, I had to go to a teacher training seminar. So other ways to sign. Except that they said a couple of interesting things. I'll tell you three of them. One of them is what I just said. One of them is that everything a person does is all for a theme. Everything a person does in their entire life is all in order to accomplish a theme. Okay? Another second and third interesting thing is that for every one positive vibe you get in the course of the day, positive reaction from another person and so on and so forth, you get 29 negative ones. Okay? People look at you like you're weird.
Not 28, just 29.
I don't know how she likes it. I don't know if that's amazing. She's from California, so I don't trust any of this. Then what she said also is that if you want to get people's kids to so focus on something, you have to use markers. One of the markers, you say, like what I'm about to tell you is absolutely brilliant. Or, if you remember nothing else tonight, then remember this. That was like a marker, right? You should mark the word. If you really said, there's a whole Gemara in Sukh and Yom Tov where it talks about zugos. Zugos are not to do things in pairs. In sets of two.
That's a good section,
Sukh. Yes, because then the demons come and they zap you, right?
Not to do things in pairs.
For instance, right. Don't have two wives. Have three.
Okay.
Right. Then there's one. The initial question there is, how can we have four cups of wine the night of Pesach, but Amos is not doing things in pairs?
Why is it that the demons are more offended by a pair than a trilogy?
Because the whole concept of evil is duality. Is that obvious?
No.
No.
No?
Evil, the whole concept of evil is duality, that there's a good and a bad side to everything. But why would the evil be attracted to pairs rather than twos rather than threes?
Because then there's a one. It's a one plus something.
So they like, the duality reminds them that they're part of things. It's like being
an all. Yeah, right. It's like, it's like you're summoning them. Right?
It's a three. That means that there's good and evil, and that there's God also, and they don't want to be part
right.
of that.
Right, five, seven, all those are good, right? Because Kohanim, right, the blessing of the Kohanim, three words, five words, seven words, right? No double...
15 total.
Right? 15 all together.
If you don't believe in demons, you don't have to worry about
the stuff, right? Oh, so the Miuri says an amazing thing. So as I said, remember nothing else, remember the Miuri. The Miuri says, really, because I didn't believe in demons. They knew all the stuff was a bunch of baloney. So why they spend pages and pages writing it? Because they live in countries in which the common man believes in demons, and demons life was like a basic assumption of life. And if they didn't deal with common people on their own level, The common people think they were crazy. What do you mean you don't believe in demons? It's an exciting part. We're talking about demons.
You're excited. Very exciting.
So the, what do you mean we don't believe in demons? Demons are all over the place. There's a demon there, demon there, everywhere. So therefore, the rabbis, in order not to lose the commoners, and not because they believe it, they play to the commoners' perceptions.
So the Yuri says this?
Yes.
And that goes with the Rambam, right?
What?
That goes in
line with the Rambam. Well, yes, in line with the Rambam. That's, the Rambam doesn't say this, but the Rambam, we can imagine Rambam saying this. So in order not to lose the masses, they play to them by using the, coming up with all this demonology and discussing it.
So should you learn the parts of the Gemara?
Now, that analysis that you just gave us, within the spectrum of Orthodox thinking.
And Eerie was a big man.
Okay.
Yeah. He was big. We don't mess with him, Eerie.
What was
he was Menachem.
Menachem
Neri. He lived in the 1300s in Italy.
Really?
Yeah.
So do we get credit for learning Torah if we learn those pages?
That's an interesting question. You know, we have there's several pages in Shas, and one goes on for several pages about things,
right,
you know, which are medical, according to the medicine of the day, or according to demonology, whether you can make a Bichah Satola on that. So the assumption is that since it got into the Gemara, it must have some Torah value.
Right.
But, this is a good question.
So should someone not do the things in those parts of the Gemara? Like, for instance, in, I think in that section of Tzachim, it says, you know, don't walk between a palm tree and a wall or something, don't sleep with your head on a tree, on a cut-down tree stump. So should people be worried about those things? Or, like, stepping over a branch, make sure you step on the branch instead of over it, otherwise...
Well, most people are not good on any of those things except for walking between two women.
Women. People are still mocked about that?
Yeah, people are
still sorcery?
People are mocked not to walk between two women or have one woman walk between two men. What you're supposed to do if you find yourself in that situation...
Grab your tip.
What? Grab
your
tip. Anything.
What?
Grab your shirt sleeve. You grab something in your hand, like your shirt sleeve.
Oh, okay.
So that's a hashtag, an interruption between you and the woman or who's next to her.
What about not drinking water on Friday night and Wednesday night?
Huh?
And stuff like that.
People
or storing food under your bed or...
Storing food under your bed, I think people don't do, but...
this is gross.
But the... I think it's considered to be like, not
a
today. But...
Does Shulchan Aruch bring down any of these types of practices?
It does. It brings down a few of them in Simchat Kuf Dezayin Yerodeah.
Yeah.
But you know, most of them are reasonable ones. For example, like not to leave the cut nets pulled out because animals might come and
might not to leave water overnight.
And not to drink water at night, you know, things like that at night. Yeah, if you can't see what's in the water. To speak about things that a person should not do because they're dangerous. Kuktei Zayin, in Yerodeah, it's mostly stuff that you're not allowed to leave open. Like it says, you're not supposed to drink from beverages which were left open overnight because maybe a snake drank from them. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't eat milk and meat together because it causes leprosy, and you should wash your hands between milk and meat. Some of the Shurama says you have to be careful. You should not consume any sweat of a person except for the sweat of the face, which is considered to be safe. I don't know who gets the sweat of the rest of the body. It's not considered to be safe. And you're not supposed to put money in your mouth because you might have all sorts of germs on them. So it's mostly logical things. You don't actually have that.
What about like drinking liquid from a plate and like looking at yourself naked in the mirror and things like that? That like these are things like the Gemara says will make you anxious for like 2 weeks and you won't know why you're anxious or things of that nature.
Yeah, it's not brought down. None of these things are brought down.
So you don't need to worry about those things at all?
Right. The only one which is brought down, which we don't do anymore either, is not to drink water at the time of the change of the season.
Which is what?
What?
Why?
What is that?
When is the change of season? Well, that's a problem, because we no longer have the same seasons they had at the time of the Gemara. But every how many days is the season? Every 90...
90-odd days.
So there actually is, if you look at a Ruach, as the standard Ezra's calendar, you'll see it actually has a, it tells you when the Yom HaTkufa is. It says here because the blood down is that a drop of blood falls into the water between season and season. But the Ibn Ezra, the Bernard brings down here the commentary when the Ibn Ezra, was way back early, said that this is all a bunch of baloney. And there is no danger whatsoever. By the way, once we're on this topic, you know, one of the things in Judaism, the thing which bothers me the most in Judaism, is the same Talmud Motzah Livracha.
Saying what?
The same Talmud Motzah Livracha. December 5th, every year, we start saying, instead of the same bracha, the same Talmud Motzah Livracha, right?
What is that?
In Baruch Olam. Take a look and consider.
The prosperity.
No. Take a look at the Siddur on page 104.
But that's
just going to say,
but
it's only a paper. No, it's right in the same. It's a chutzah. If you take a look at page 104, in the following blessing, the same bracha is recited Chol Moed Pesach through Mincha December 4th, or a 5th in the year before civil leap year. The same Talmud is recited from Maariv December 4th or 5th until Pesach. Ring a bell by anybody?
Yeah.
Why December 4th or December 5th?
I don't know.
Because this is when it is, it goes by Israel, it goes by weather in Israel. That's why they have to set it there.
It goes, it's 60 days after fall begins.
Okay.
Does that work? When does fall begin?
I don't know.
You don't know when fall begins?
End of September, beginning of October.
September 21st.
Okay.
When 60 days after the beginning of fall?
September, October, November 21st.
November 21st.
Right.
And yet don't say till December 4th.
Why?
Why not? Because this is still, we're still saying the same time Motzei Bracha based on the Julian calendar. Even though the entire world, after the Russian Revolution, the entire world is now on the Gregorian calendar. That means that, you know, just like the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, they have Christmas 11 days, 12 days after everybody else, sometime in January, because it's still going by the Julian calendar. So we are still going by the same time, also the Bracha, by the seasonal change in the Julian calendar. And the Julian calendar keeps on galloping further ahead of the Gregorian calendar. And therefore, the same time also gets later and later and later, like one day a century, this way it is.
So wait, so would we be sinning if we decided to start saying it?
Well, that's the point. The point is, that halacha is, if I don't sound, tell me, this is my most difficult thing about Judaism. The halacha is, if you miss the same time of the Livracha,
if you miss it
after December 4th, you repeat Shmon Esrei. If you say it before December 4th, you repeat Shmon Esrei.
Wait. If we say it after November 21st, we have to repeat Shmon Esrei without it.
Right.
But
you don't repeat the other one, right?
No, you do.
The other way around,
I think that... No, that's why I'm not reading Talmashi Ruach Miradeshen.
Oh.
Not by this. So
that's not good.
Right, so it bothers me immensely why we still keep the Julian calendar for this purpose.
Isn't it supposed to be Mamash 60 days after start of fall?
And another thing, Pesach is not allowed to be in the winter, right? The only reason why Pesach is not in the winter is because of the Gregorian calendar. According to the Julian calendar, by which spring starts, well, how many days later? 12 days later, 15 days later, Pesach very often comes out in the middle of the winter. So because the season only changes after the season, only Julian season, Julian season almost always changes, not almost always, very frequently changes after Pesach. So the only reason that Pesach can be legitimate, because Pesach has been in spring, is because of the Gregorian calendar.
Yes.
Yet here, from the same time of the Livracha, we are adamantly, strictly keeping the Julian calendar.
Both of which are Goyish.
What?
Both of which are
Goyish. Yes, but they're both mentioned in the Gemara. It's not like that.
Both of them are mentioned in the Gemara.
Yes, both are mentioned in the Gemara. They're just not mentioned as Julian Gregorian.
Right.
There's the approximate solar cycle, which is 365 and a quarter days, which is the Julian calendar. The Julian calendar is based on 365 and a quarter. And then there's the more precise solar calendar, which is, you know, a little bit less. Mm-hmm. A few minutes less, which the Gregorian calendar compensates for. How does the Gregorian calendar compensate for that?
Leap year every 4 years. A leap day or whatever.
No, that every leap year which is supposed to happen in a millennium year, 1900, 2000, and so on and so forth, are not leap years. That's the Gregorian calendar compensates for that. Year 2000 wasn't a leap year. Nobody remembers?
It was supposed to be?
Yeah.
We were so worried about other things in the year 2000. We overlooked.
And 2004, this year's a leap year.
This year's a leap year, right.
Allow me to go back to the previous...
What's the answer? So hasn't this been raised anywhere? Like, yeah. Has anyone come out and said, this is ridiculous, we're holding by one calendar halakhically, so to the extent that it's usher to not hold by it in one case part of the year, and in the other part of the year we're holding by the other calendar halakhically, so that is, there's no problem. No one has a problem with this.
Nobody can say anything definitive about it.
Who would have to say something for it to change?
I don't know.
With like that rabbi who visited America recently, like
no.
He came out and said, this is ridiculous.
They would stone him if he said that.
But he's like the leader.
Yeah, but they would demonstrate against him in the streets of Marcy.
That's right.
The freedom don't like him. So I don't know who actually...
What if the New Square Rebbe came out and said this is ridiculous?
No.
I just really have a question more related to sort of the geography of this structure of the prayers. As you move along page 87 to basically Kadosh.
We're way before.
Oh, I understand that. I understand you're stuck up here.
Yeah.
Okay. What I wanted to really get at is, did the author of this particular bracha really have in mind the entire legion of all the angels that were known, specifically visualized,
I think,
as well as basically almost a Kabbalistic view of the luminous lights of these.
I mentioned before you came in that this bracha is how we kind of got sidetracked onto demons. Yeah, you came in by the demons. Before you came in,
I was in the Sefer.
We were talking about the angels. So this bracha takes angels and demons of reality and describes to you how angels are and how they work. It's a very, very almost matter-of-fact bracha about angels.
It's basically to all build to more of a heart. This is like a climactic build-up. I mean, all the language to get you to the point where you're going to be raising your...
Right. We're going to think about it when we get there. Yeah.
Help to continue his question, Zohar. Being with some background, Saudi background, you learn a lot of things, and two words are they come up all the time, Kasha and Segula. You just think it's Segula for this, you learn this, and Shishka. Like, for example, you take a bread. So if you cut it, and you cut the corner, and you eat it, as opposed to a middle piece, then it's Kasha l'shichecha. You help you forget things. Now, if we take this and analyze it, does that mean that really if you eat this you're going to forget things, or there is a significance to this, but to talk to the masses, they kind of scare them, saying, oh, if you do this you're going to forget what you learned or something. So they won't transgress whatever other significance there is there. Or it's all boiled altogether. Because everybody, like you're going to have sons, like children and sons, as opposed to daughters if you do this. And all kinds of things that they motivate you. And again, was it a language for the masses, or was it saying the real thing?
Well, there would be a different sort of thing. The mirror would hold it was just done in order to make the masses happy, and other sources would hold it there's something real to it.
But take the piece of the bread. Does that mean that you really shouldn't eat it?
But the reason given is not the real reason, but there is a reason not to eat a piece of that piece of bread.
Saying, are there other reasons that we're not
It could be.
Close?
No, it could be. I understand what you're saying. But there is also a rational approach to these things. The rational approach, for example, I mean, not the other approach is irrational, but let's say not so much the bread one, because they don't really...
What about rubies for...
No, I got a better one.
Don't sleep on your clothes because you...
Don't sleep on your clothes, or don't wear two garments at the same time, right? Two of the same garments. You're not supposed to put on two hats.
Don't try to make fun of these things.
No. I'm not making fun of them either. They're just trying to say that there you give a rational explanation and say the reason is because such a person who's a frivolous kind of person or is not caring about his garments, so such a person is going to be a forgetful person too. Because he's not doesn't care about the details and the significance of details. That's the way you'd approach it from a rationalistic viewpoint. See what I'm saying? In other words, that kind of behavior...
The effects of the baby. How can you affect things like this?
It doesn't affect. What affects?
No, not that. Like the other things, like you should eat, I don't know, carrots or something.
That's nonsense.
All the things...
That's nonsense. That's not for the Gemara.
So what do you draw the line?
Things are from the Gemara. Things are the Gemara. You should try and assume that they're not nonsense. You know, therefore, you know, either you say it's the
original. Well, Ben Ishchai, who is basing everything almost on Kabbalistic sources, and when you learn, I didn't learn Mishnah Berurah before. I learned Ben Ishchai, and you know, with all the respect to him, but every page you have like a ton of things that are, you know, weird to do that a person never said before. So. Yes, good sources.
He's
not.
I tell you a story. I can't answer directly. I'm answering directly. Once, this I heard that Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Rosh Hashiva, was Rosh Hashiva in Baltimore, died about a few years ago. He said once he made a miracle. How did he make a miracle? A childless couple came to him, and what they said, you know, what should we do? In order we should have children. They're very upset. They're very depressed. So he said to have them. I promise you, you'll have children in a year. Okay, promise. They went home. Lo and behold, they had children within a year. So they figured for sure he made a miracle. So they came back to him and thanked him. He said it wasn't a miracle at all. I read some. I understand. I guess he asked doctors that if when people are tense and anxious, so their capacity to reproduce is diminished. So therefore, I promised you to have a kid within a year, because that way you wouldn't be tense and anxious anymore. And that way you're able to procreate and have kids. So the same thing, you know, when a Ben Ishchai gives a remedy, probably it really doesn't work. But there's always that kind of placebo effect, meaning that if a Ben Ishchai said it, I feel that it should work, so then it does work for me.
When you say the placebo effect, placebo, there's something about that that's wrong, because a placebo doesn't do anything. But in reality, it might be that triggers something within your body, within your mind,
right.
That does...
Like I was going to say, the fact that the Ben Ishchai says something triggers something within my mind, which changes my balance and makes something actually physiological occur.
It happens with real placebos, too. People think they're taking a pill to make their headache go away, and their headache will go away. Because their brain assumes that it's going to go away, and so creates that reality.
Yeah, but maybe different placebos are good for different things.
Depends on the shape.
The color. What about like wearing a ruby for like a easy birth, if someone's having birth difficulties, stuff like that? Is that like placebo effect, basically? Or
I think so. I don't think there's any quality.
What about like all the...
Maybe someday they discover that a ruby has a specific... emits a specific vibration, a specific, you know, a wave, and that actually causes the birth to go easier, but I don't know. I wouldn't put any money on it.
What about the Kabbalists and Sfas? They do these things all the time. I mean, people have little hands all over the place and little rocks.
I know, once in my life I went to a Kabbalist. Somebody told me, you know, when I was in Chicago, he said that you should go see the Kabbalist, this is the real thing. Okay. So I went to see the Kabbalist. So I figured, you know, I was in the middle of learning Yerushalmi, I was writing a sefer, I figured I was going to go to the fellow and I'm going to get charged with a bracha to succeed in my learning, to succeed in my teaching, to succeed in my writing, and I was all excited about that. And probably there's going to be some secrets of the Kabbalah along the way, right? So I go in, I'm really excited. He said, the first thing he said to me is, you have to move. You know, so I looked at him like he was crazy. So you see, he was dealing with a skeptic. So he said, look, I don't think you have to, you don't really have to move, change around something in the kitchen, you know, the wife wants to buy something new, you know, that's also like moving. Anyway, that wasn't what I was there for. So I said, yeah, but what about the ruchnius? What about the spiritual stuff? He said, he gave me some sort of bracha. I said, yeah, but the spiritual stuff. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but he said, so then he told me some very superficial idea, some pseudo idea on the word branches to begin. So I don't really remember what it was. Nothing which was open new vistas of thought to me. And,
You could tell that you weren't ready for it.
I wrote about it.
Right.
I wrote about a check and I left. Now, in fact, we did leave Chicago a couple years later. But the Kabbalist, the experience was a very negative experience to me on the whole. I shouldn't say very negative, but negative because they're not, the way the Kabbalists work, they are the modern-day Kabbalists. They are out to give you brachos. The popular brachos, the ones for money, the ones for kids, the ones to find a wife, all those things, and they can't really handle, unfortunately, the requests for a spiritual blessing. So,
a con man.
No, even this one, it's not stipulated, they're not a con man, but it's just, they're not,
the whole Kabbalah is just mastery of psychology, of knowing which buttons to press by saying, and if you say that, then you can go further on, and it's pretty scary because, you know, you think that these are the Gleil Elokim Chaim and this and that, and all of a sudden, you see that it's just the sound of wisdom, you know, it's part of it.
Right, that's why the Mitznagdim traditionally held not to go to Kabbalists, or Rebbes, because they felt that this was a shortcoming in what the Torah says, just be Tamim, be holy and innocently involved with Hashem and don't pay attention to all this kind of stuff.
Did you say Rebbe's too?
Mm-hmm. Sure. In the old days. You wouldn't go to Rebbe. Yeah.
What about males? Are pregnant women supposed to be males?
That's brought down by the Ramon Shulchan Aruch, so people are more masculine on that. I have no rational explanation for that one.
Nails?
When you cut your nails, you're supposed to dispose of them, not supposed to leave them, throw them out in the normal way, or leave them lying around. You're supposed to either flush them down the toilet.
I heard that the Shulchan Aruch says that Likud Alma, everybody agrees that if a pregnant woman goes over a piece of nail, then she's going to lose the baby.
Yeah,
it's brought like trip over or something.
This is brought down by halacha, so people are more stringent about that. Very few of these things are actually brought down by halacha.
What about dropping the fork?
I don't
have to drop the fork.
I don't know
about go over it.
I was a little nervous because the pregnant woman would step on it and fall and miscarry or something like that.
It would be a big hangnail.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's my fashion.
I had a story once.
I'd rather say I don't understand it than give that answer.
That didn't give it a long time ago.
The rabbi I knew of that used to go to the mikveh and he had a lot of followers. And one time after he came out from the mikveh, he sat on the floor and he cut his nails in his toenails, right? So he's cutting them and everybody asked him what's the Kabbalistic significance. He said, no, the nails are soft after the water.
Yeah. It's like the bird story with the rabbi was at in Shiva. There was like a bird that flew into the base entrance and was like sitting on top of the Arna Kodesh, tripping away or something. And it was there for like 3 hours and came every day. And then one of the Talmud went up to the Rosh Hashiva and he said, you know, maybe it's a Gilgul, maybe we should say a bracha and try to release its soul and this and that. And like the big Rosh Hashiva just looks up from the safe and he says, maybe it's just a bird.
So the bottom line is that all these things which we have in the Gemara and later sources, we don't know where to draw the line. There is a line which certainly should be drawn between things which are superstition and things which have perhaps some substance to them.
Isn't there a line of being an Isser too? If you're too superstitious, you're violating...
Of course, there's a prohibition of being superstitious in and of itself. I'm saying the things which are called, not called superstitions, when they want it to be, the nice term they give it is a segula. Mm-hmm. Segula means, you know, something which gets you heavenly blessing in some easy way. So it's hard to know where to draw the line. You know, I assume, that most of the things which are passed off as being, you know, on one hand dangerous, on the other hand, especially effective in either, you know, losing or gaining divine favor, are not really that significant. and that really what really counts is your own personal effort and toil. But that's because I'm a misnagid. If I was a chassid, I may well have a much more, you know, mystical approach to these things.
Excuse me, even as misnagid, you discount believing in the surreal?
I don't discount it, but I'm skeptical about it. I'm always keeping an open mind, but I haven't seen the surreal, so therefore I'm skeptical about it.
I mean, are you 5th century, are you 6th century, multi-century?
5th century. Yes.
Oh, now, I've had some 6th century. Even I.
Dan, see you.
I don't believe it. You're shattering my faith.
I was once driving home from college, from Temple University. I was driving home through North Philadelphia with my friend Belenki sitting next to me. Belenki was there. And I stopped at an intersection, and there was a traffic light, and the traffic light went green, and I was just frozen. And he said, "Go, the light is green." And I said, all of a sudden, a car comes screeching through the intersection backwards and smashes into a pillar on the other side of the street, going through precisely where the car would have gone if I had gone through the green light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe I heard it in the distance, imperceptibly, at a very low sound that I couldn't consciously hear. I felt the vibrations of the car, and that's what stopped me from going. But the windows were closed, and I don't think that was just sensory perceptions. I think that there's something that froze me for a moment to keep me from getting crashed up in that intersection.
Oh, God. But, so to the best of my conscious recollection, I never had an episode like that.
I've had things similar.
Did you target me with your life?
I just said, now we can go.
You never had that situation?
Yeah. That's it? You don't believe that everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to you with your partnership with him?
Yeah, I believe you.
Yeah.
I have a book about this.
I would like to believe it, but I can't
say much about
it.
In the Army.
That means you try to believe it, if you can. I mean, that's part of your effort.
But, well, yes, part of my, it's, I don't know if it's part of my effort, but it's something which I think is probably true.
I think that's what
the Chancellor is involved in everything, even though it's a matter of question and Jewish thought.
I think you're a great teacher. I missed you last week. I have to do something, but I'm so happy I came here. But I'm just curious that you cannot think about one particular moment. I think almost everybody in this room has had something that's happened to them in their life that justifies rationality. In their relationship with Hashem, you can't think of one thing.
But you say there's no Ashgacha Pratit.
No, there are. I think there is Ashgacha Pratit. To that extent, I'm willing to take on the Hasidic approach. But nevertheless, when you say Ashgacha Pratit, it's not the same thing. I feel that, let's say, when I was my 30 year in childhood, and I didn't want to come back to go to college, and then I went to. Does anybody hear the story from me yet?
No.
So when I was my third, this is not an extrasensory thing, just an episode which I believe is Hashgacha Pratit. What happened was that I was my third year in college, then Shalvim, and after high school in Yeshiva, I didn't want to come back and go to college. My parents wanted me to come back to college. And the Rosh Hashiva of Shalvim did not want to tell me what to do, so he sent me to his own Rosh Hashiva, to Shlomo Zalman Reuerbach, one of the big gardens. So I went to Shlomo Zalman's house, Shari Chesed, and I went upstairs, met him, and I gave him this paper, letter of introduction. I said the choices were either for me to stay in Israel or to go back to America and learn in Baltimore and go to college. And he said, go back to Baltimore.
Really?
And I made a face. Inadvertently. And he said, what's the matter? I don't like my sock. And I said, no, it's fine. It's fine. We're going to your sock. He said, you'll go back to America for a couple of years. And, you know, your parents will see you don't want to go to college. And they'll let you come back to Israel, and everything will be fine and dandy. We didn't say use their language, but, you know. And so, you know, we're up next to the Yeshiva, called him up and asked him, did you mean this? Really, it doesn't sound like a halachic issue, right? He said, yes. It's a psach. It's a halachic ruling. In which case, you know, I had no choice but to abide by it. You ask, you have to follow. So, and I went back to America, And I came back to Israel 2 years later. I happened to come back with a master's degree in counseling because in Baltimore you get away with those things. Mm-hmm. But I was back in 2 years. And it was also a very, I think it was a very, very important experience for me to be in Baltimore. It was a long-term life-shaping experience. So I believe that God was involved in that decision. That's the talk of Shlomo Zalman. I believe that Shlomo Zalman, perhaps he had a sixth sense, and that therefore he was able to proceed. But I just experienced it as, you know, Ashtach HaChadish, but there was no, like, transcendent spiritual aspect to it.
If I may, I think, I mean, I'm convinced that Hashem is involved in everything, but when I say Ashtach HaChadish, that means that in what you're saying today, maybe you can say it in retrospective, it was better, it was in Baltimore, but when you see it right there, right on the spot, you come to, I don't know, to, that he's about to step on the accelerator, and he doesn't. He doesn't know why, and all of a sudden, a car goes by. Something stops him from doing an automatic thing that he does all the time. He's green, he steps on the gas. I had something similar. And you ask yourself, why didn't I step on the gas? What? It's like something stopped. And you see, I mean, as the competition is in everything, but sometimes you can see that, you can see it.
But that, I don't have any conscious recollection of such experience. That's what I'm telling you. And I don't think that that's Ashkach HaPratis. I think that that is, I don't think that that's,
insight into,
I don't think that that's the definition of Ashkach HaPratis. That's the definition of a, you know, a, like an extrasensory moment. Something which becomes, transcends your normal consciousness, comes from somewhere else. But that's not saying Ashkach HaPratis. Ashkach HaPratis is believing, let's say, that your decision to come to Eretz Sameach was something which was divinely driven into you because this is what the best thing would be for you at this point in time. You don't have to feel that was an existential decision. It might have been a very rational decision for your part. But still, it's Ashkach for you to be here.
What would be the difference between sixth sense and Ruach HaKodesh?
Ruach HaKodesh
is
from a holy source.
Right.
We believe that those who believe in inspiration from other senses besides the actual waking senses believe the inspiration does not necessarily have to come from a holy source.
Where does it come from?
It is because the neshama has waves of perceiving things which you don't normally have access to.
The neshama is a holy source.
Yeah, no, but it's not something which comes from Hashem. That was the neshama itself.
Right,
that's your own neshama. That's not Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh is when Hashem bestows upon you a special awareness.
So the difference would be if Ben's neshama knew that car was coming and didn't want to go up to Shemayim yet, so stopped them, versus Hashem saw it. Well, Hashem saw anything,
yeah.
Everything, but like, versus Hashem directly sending a malach to stop Dan from...
Usually when we use the term Ruach HaKodesh, in that sense, it means Hashem gives us more wisdom, more insight.
Right.
Not that Hashem, now we get, you know, a sudden sense. Uh-oh. Yeah, stop. That's not
the thing with the court, in Shemayim, could it be, I'm sorry, Dan, if it offends us.
No, no, no.
Could it be that you went through the light, and the car hit him, and that's it, and he went up there, and there was a bad deal for the mother. And he would have, and he said, no, I want to come back, I want to, whatever, I want to be a better Jew, and this and that, I'm not ready to die yet, and they gave a psalm, or exiled him, okay, that's it, he goes back. So he goes back, and they kind of change the clock a little bit, and then all of a sudden, don't step on the... I mean, you know what I'm saying? Because...
Why?
Because if a person dies, I tell you why. If a person dies, you go back. Why would you go back?
Listen.
One of my rabbis once said,
his rebbe, they was a business announcer who was very distinguished in the Holy Rosh Hashanah in Jerusalem. So once somebody came to him and told him over a tremendous Torah novel idea, Chiddush. And the business announcer said, what's compelling you to say that? It's very nice, but what's compelling you to say that? There has to be some compelling reason to say you're Chiddush. Do you have a compelling reason? He said, no, I don't. So he walked away. It was crestfallen. So the Talmidim said to Mrs. Zalman, I don't know if this story is true, but it's a good story. Talmidim said to Mrs. Zalman, but Rebbe, in Shir last week you said the same Chiddush. He said, no, I had a compelling reason. I had to say Shir. Well, he doesn't have to say Shir, so what's compelling him to say the Chiddush? So, yes, you can say a Chiddush, that everything went in Shamayim out like that. What's compelling you to say that? What right do you have to take it that far?
Maybe because I have a problem with logic, that if you go to a Bedin and you have a chance of, they will tell you, okay, you're going to leave. But the very fact that you made it there, that means you died. So
he didn't experience going up to a basis. He didn't need to see the heavenly tribunal in his mind.
Maybe there was a tribunal at the moment just before it was going to happen. And my grandparents got up there and made an argument for me.
Maybe. Who knows?
That way they don't have to turn back time. Because I know that's the Superman thing.
Plus, if he could remember the tribunal, then that would be a knock against free will. And then he would be a prophet and we would have to...
And maybe the argument made was, let him through this and he'll go to Orsa Maya.
It could be.
And then the court said he has to have some crazy girlfriends first.
That way you can do tshuva.
That's right.
A lot of missed choice.
Right.
Okay, guys. We'll stop here for today.